Hello, hello. Welcome back to another episode of A to Easy. I have Yvonne here with me.
Hello, yes. It's been a while, hasn't it?
It's fine. We'll just call this like season two or something. Like we've definitely meant to have this really long gap. But also a warm welcome to any new third years who have recently started again or should be starting firms again soon.
And what are we covering today?
COPD, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. But that sounds long because everyone calls it COPD.
Okay, and what is COPD?
Well, breaking it down, it's a chronic disease process which causes an obstructive lung pathology.
What do you mean by obstructive?
Oh, okay. So this is like a technical question. So when we're talking about respiratory diseases, there are two sort of camps we can divide them into, okay? There's obstructive, then there's restrictive pictures. You can work out what type of problem the patient has by using spirometry, okay, which one of those two camps they fall into. And remember that spirometry is a clinical test looking at breathing. It involves asking the patient to breathe in as deeply as they can and breathe out as hard and fast as they then can. We can also give certain medications to see if they change their ability to breathe during that test. It's commonly done in both primary and secondary care. This is hopefully jogging some painful memories of phrases like FEV1 and FVC.
Yes. I have to say, in Jerry's, it doesn't come up often because it's already like dealt with by the respiratory team, luckily enough. But yes, I remember a few things from back in medical school.
Okay, well, let's try and keep it simple then. So FEV1 is the forced expiratory volume a person can produce over 1 second, aka how much air you breathe out in a second when you're exhaling as hard as you physically can. It's actually really uncomfortable to do, and the thing to remember, this isn't actually how you normally breathe as a person. So it's like a lab measure version. And the FVC, on the other hand, is the forced vital capacity. I used to get this thing wrong all the time, and I mixed up with total lung capacity. These are slightly different things. The FVC is at the end of complete exhalation, where you have tried to breathe out as much as you physically can. The reason this is not your entire lung volume is because you actually have some residual lung volume, which is also sometimes termed dead space. This makes sense because otherwise, if you got rid of all the volume, you'd collapse your airway every time you took a breath in, and that would be really bad as you wouldn't have an airway.
Yeah, sounds like it. So FEV1 is exhaling as much as you can in 1 second, whereas FVC is exhaling as much as you can, full stop.
Yes, exactly. So what we do is we take these two measurements and compare them. We look at the ratio between how much you can breathe out quickly, FEV1, versus how much you can breathe out overall.
So this is the FEV1 over FEVC ratio.
Yes, absolutely. That thing, that horrendous thing that hopefully now makes a bit more sense. And this is where we finally get back to obstructive and restrictive. Obstruction is where a tube is blocked and its contents can't move past the blockage, right?
Yes, a bit like a crash on a motorway causing the road to close. I had one of those in the weekend and it was horrible. It took me 4 hours to go to Bristol instead of 2.5. Anyhow.
At least you got time to go to Bristol. Anyway, exactly. But remember, if you had a fully blocked off airway, you would be dead. Okay, point one. So in respiratory terms, an obstructive picture isn't the complete blockage. It's more of a rate limiting step. Think back to like A-level chemistry reactions or learning what made plants grow in biology, I guess.
So like a traffic jam, not rather than a full crash stopping everyone.
Yeah, so the motorway isn't closed. So some air can move past the blockage, but it's less than normal. This reduces the volume of air you can breathe out in a short period of time, right? And what does that sound like?
Like a reduction in FEV1?
Yeah, okay, yeah. So in obstructive spirometry pictures, we have less FEV1 compared to FVC. And before you ask, yes, the obstructive picture can cause a slight reduction in FVC as well, but we are interested in the ratio and the FEV1 is much more affected. So that's the shorthand that you need to understand.
So what sort of ratio suggests an obstructive picture exactly?
Well, an FEV1-FVC ratio less than 0.7, which is sometimes referred to as less than 70%. This makes sense if you really think that it's about fractions. So 7 is the FEV1 and it's relative to the FVC, which is 10. So an FEV1 of 7 is reduced compared to the FVC of 10. So that sort of level suggests an obstructive picture.
Is this episode going to be this level of complicated?
No. Okay, don't turn off. At least in my opinion, that's probably the hardest concept we're going to talk about today. So it's going to get easier from here. You've done the hard bit, that's why I did it first.
Okay, good. So COPD, as the name suggests, causes an obstructive respiratory picture on spirometry. Do any other diseases do that?
Yes, quite a few, annoyingly. But a key differential in terms of spirometry is asthma, okay? This is because asthma, when severe, causes airway obstruction and collapse. The key difference here is that asthma is reversible, COPD is not.
Okay, so that's why it is specifically called chronic obstructive pulmonary disease.
Bingo. Okay, I mentioned earlier we can give drugs during spirometry. So giving salbutamol, which is a bronchodilator beta-2 agonist that you might remember from PhARM, opens the airways up in asthma, but it can't reverse the disease processes going on in COPD. So that's a really useful way clinically, okay, giving someone salbutamol, to tell us the difference between asthma and COPD, because COPD there won't be an effect hugely.
Okay, so to differentiate between asthma and COPD, you give salbutamol, a bronchodilator, which in asthma it will cause a reversible change, whereas in COPD it won't do as much.
Mm-hmm.
So we know that it causes an obstructive picture. How does it do that?
Remember that COPD is really a mixture of two conditions, chronic bronchitis and emphysema. So pop quiz, what is the definition of chronic bronchitis?
Well, clinically, it's having a regular productive cough for at least 3 months in a row for at least 2 years.
Yes, textbook perfect. Yeah, so chronic bronchitis is basically just a productive cough that doesn't go away and it isn't due to an infection. Meanwhile, emphysema is...
Emphysema is more of a radiological term. It's where the alveoli become permanently enlarged and can combine to form bullae.
Yeah, so it's different to things like bronchiectasis because it's happening at the alveoli and it's not happening higher up in the respiratory tree. But COPD is the combination of these two issues and is caused by what? Okay, don't overthink this. What's COPD caused by?
Smoking.
Yes, wonderful, right? So this is easier, okay? But in terms of a differential diagnosis, we already know asthma can present similar in terms of spirometry. Is there any other disease which you can think mimics COPD? So say if it's not asthma in a younger person who isn't a smoker?
Alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency?
Exactly. And to everyone who has not heard of that mouthful, you can just know that it's a genetic disorder that can affect the liver and the lungs. So you get these weird features of COPD at a much younger age, and they're not really a smoker. And it's one of those weird diseases that can crop up in harder SBAs, which is why you ask a medical student who's done third year and they've heard of it suddenly.
Yeah, it's not exactly common compared to COPD.
Indeed. And since you mention it, COPD is very, very common. Since we know it is predominantly caused by smoking, it presents in older adults as it takes time to build up that chronic, substantial pack year history. And also, rather positively, young generations are smoking less tobacco now.
How does smoking cause COPD exactly?
Well, as with everything in medicine, there is a long and a short answer. Let's go with the short. There are thousands of chemicals in cigarettes, as you were told as a child, and in cigarettes, breathing in all that leads up to chronic inflammation over time. And that chronic inflammatory response causes progressive remodeling of the lungs due to the loss of elastin. That's what causes emphysema, basically. And it promotes mucus production, which leads to the chronic cough of chronic bronchitis.
Okay, fair enough. So moving on to something more clinical. Let's say we have a patient with COPD. How do they present?
Well, in classical teaching, there are two types of COPD patients, okay? There are those who retain CO2 and those who do not. They are given some fairly odd names. Can you remember what they are?
Yeah, because they're quite funny. It's pink puffers and blue bloaters.
So the reason you have these two archetypal presentations for COPD is because, as we said before, COPD is made up of those two conditions. Pink puffers have more emphysematous COPD, and blue bloaters are more on the chronic bronchitis side of the spectrum. So think of it as blue bloaters have bronchitis, is maybe a quick way to remember it, okay?
And do we know why that's the case?
To be honest, this is a topic I found super, super confusing. So here we go. Let's try and fix my errors the last few years. So let's start out with blue bloaters and chronic bronchitis. They make lots of mucus, and this, alongside other things, leads to a form of airway obstruction. They can't breathe out effectively, and as a result, they retain CO2. Chronically, as a result, they become used to having high CO2 levels and low oxygen levels. The hypoxemia leads to a cyanosis and prevents them from doing vigorous exercise, which promotes an association with a higher BMI. So basically, because they're limited by their hypoxia, they get fatter and they are called blue bloaters because they're cyanotic as well. The key concept with pink puffers, on the other hand, is their relationship to CO2 is different. Their bodies are not yet used to high CO2 levels, and so they use rapid, often like pursed-lipped breathing in a classically tripod-type position to help them blow off their CO2 by exhaling it out. That constant shortness of breath, heavy breathing, is really uncomfortable and increases their energy expenditure because they're literally working so hard. So these patients classically have a lower BMI instead.
So can patients start off as pink puffers and then become a blue bloater?
Yes, they can. So patients do simply sometimes switch over, given enough time, due to them eventually becoming tolerant of the higher CO2 that they have. And just to be clear, the terms pink puffer and blue bloater, although they can be really helpful memory aids, they are kind of insulting. So this is really for classroom conversation and it's not really for your clinical practice, but I don't want to get into a rant about that. Anyway.
All right, so we have the pink puffers that are usually like thinner, and then blue bloaters are usually larger in size, more politically correct, I guess. Okay, now we have discussed these two stereotypes of COPD patients. How do they actually present in clinical practice?
So a phrase we use a lot is an acute exacerbation of COPD, as even though it's a chronic disease process, it can suddenly get worse. These episodes can be due to an infection, namely like a pneumonia, or not due to an infection. This is how COPD patients tend to present to hospitals as clinically unwell patients with low oxygen saturations. In the community, however, before they've reached this sort of acute bad stage, they might present to the GP with progressive shortness of breath or frustration over their chronic cough that just isn't going away.
Okay, and what would you find on examination?
So in the hands, you can look for asterixis, indicative of a CO2 retention flap. They could be perfectly cyanotic as well, and you might see that from the bedside. When you're assessing the lungs, you would classically hear wheezing like in asthma. And if a patient had a barrel-type chest, which is a classical phrase we use, they would be hyper-resonant to percussion and have quiet breath sounds and auscultation. This is because their chest is bigger because they've got an increased amount of dead air space due to the emphysema. And if it's due to an effective exacerbation, you might also hear some localized crackles, aka crepitations. Also note that COPD can, when severe, be associated with severe right-sided heart failure. And therefore, we should also be checking for signs of that. So if it was an OSCE scenario, by the way, you'd be looking around the bed for inhalers and oxygen requirement as well.
Okay, so we have asterixis, cyanosis, barrel chest, a hyperresonant chest, wheezing, quiet breath sounds, and possibly right-sided heart failure. So let's say the patient comes with these features. How do we investigate them?
With a good old bedside bloods imaging approach. Okay, so at the bedside, observations such as a high respiratory rate and low oxygen saturations are suggestive, but of course not specific. A sputum culture can be useful at the bedside as well to see if it's an effective exacerbation, but they're not the most reliable things in the world. The main blood test of choice is to do an urgent ABG to assess their CO2 retention status and whether they have respiratory failure. That's your key thing you need to do, and it's always pretty much important in an acute respiratory scenario. Do an ABG. Radiologically speaking, a chest x-ray would be indicated to look for hyperinflation or an infective cause or maybe some alternative diagnosis. But a thing to remember as well is that COPD patients are more prone to developing a pneumothorax, so a chest x-ray can also diagnose one of those as a potential acute complication of their COPD. But in respiratory in general, doing an ABG and doing a chest x-ray in an acute scenario is your standard procedure, okay?
Any special tests?
So you can go down the rabbit hole thinking of really complicated tests, especially if you think it's an infective cause. But the two that people often forget are urinary antigen tests. So for Legionella, which is one of your atypical causes, and pneumococcus, which is one of your typical causes of pneumonia. And of course, the big special test is spirometry, which I mentioned at the beginning, but it tends to be done in chronic situations and it's not really sensible for the acutely unwell patient.
Okay, so we have observations, an ABG, a chest x-ray if acutely unwell. And in the community, when it's not an acute presentation, consider doing spirometry. So let's say we have diagnosed someone with COPD. Is there a way of classifying the severity?
Yes, and this is a quick, easy SBA question to write. It's called the GOLD grading, and the details of which are probably beyond the scope of third year. But it's used to grade COPD from 1 to 4, 4 being the most severe grade of obstruction, that's all to do with your FEV1, and it's also graded from A to D, depending on how frequently they develop exacerbations. So a 4D staging really just means severe obstruction and frequent exacerbations. The reason that's important is because both those factors contribute to mortality predictions.
Okay, so we have the gold grading. And now to probably my most hated question in medical school is, how do we treat COPD?
Well, it's a very broad question. and although it was in Sofia for year three last year, I think very specific questions about it are quite mean at third year level. However, since you asked, let's start with the acute management. That's probably a bit more relevant. Conservatively, it's about assessing their oxygen requirement. If you believe they are a CO2 retainer and they're therefore used to being hypoxic as well, you can aim for a lower oxygen generation SAT. That's classically 88 to 92%.
And how do you achieve that lower oxygen SAT?
So yeah, rather than just giving them 15 litres on a non-rebreather mask, use a specific mask called a Venturi mask. And it's named after the Venturi effect, which is how they work. There are a bunch of different colours for the mask, which tell you about how much oxygen they deliver. And the nurses are far better at this than us. They're very capable of monitoring a patient's oxygen saturation using these masks and therefore setting a certain saturation target.
So decide on the upper limit oxygen target and use a Venturi mask. What else?
Well, the preceding part should have formed part of your A to E assessment that you do for any acutely unwell patient. But if you put oxygen therapy under conservative measures, then medical management would be the use of nebulizers like salbutamol, nebotropium, and steroids like prednisolone. The nebulizers help promote bronchodilation, opening up the lungs, and the steroids reduce the inflammatory process, but they don't work immediately. If the patient still needs further help, you're likely heading for ventilatory support and are probably calling critical care outreach or ITU.
So, oxygen via Venturi, nebulizers, steroids, and if needed, ventilation. And what about chronic management?
So if you're asked this by a consultant, remember it's all about an MDT approach with chronic diseases, and COPD is absolutely not an exception. Conservatively, the obvious treatment is to help the patient stop smoking. Vaccination is also important, and the annual flu vaccine and one of the one-off pneumococcal vaccines are particularly important. Also, this is important to everyone, but of course the COVID vaccine is also worth mentioning here, as these patients are at increased respiratory risk of infections due to the problems with their mucociliary escalator. Physiotherapy, in the form of pulmonary rehabilitation, can also help patients tolerate their symptoms. And another key point here is education, as teaching patients about how to adapt and sort of cope with their symptoms will also help them long term. And from a medical point of view, inhaler therapy is king. COPD nurse specialists are experts at optimizing a patient's inhaler therapy. They are far better than everyone else. So that's the person you refer to and you call on to help optimize them. And in certain severe cases, you can consider long-term oxygen therapy at home, provided they have stopped smoking. Why is that important, Yvonne?
Because by putting a naked flame, like a cigarette, and an oxygen mask around someone's mouth is definitely going to go so wrong.
100%. So they can't be current smokers. For patients with chronic CO retention as well, you can consider long-term non-invasive ventilation, and that's mainly at night, and that would help them blow off their CO2.
And are there any surgical options?
So for emphysema type patients, lung volume reduction surgery to cut away the dead spaces can be performed, but I wouldn't learn anything more about that at this stage. It's really not relevant at the moment.
So we have MDT approach, smoking cessation, vaccinations, pulmonary rehabilitation, and then inhalers, and possibly long-term oxygen therapy in those who have successfully stopped smoking.
And that's how we manage COPD in a nutshell.
Okay, and as with everything, are there any particular complications patients with COPD are at risk of?
Well, as we spoke about earlier, there's infections and there are pneumothoraces. And similarly, because of the inflammatory process that's going on, lung cancer chronically. Also remember that chronic shortness of breath as a symptom can actually really restrict someone's activities of daily living. And at its worst, it can make someone become breathless even just putting on or taking off their clothes. So that can really affect their life. So those are the main complications. And as a parting gift, I wanted to talk about something that people get asked all the time on the ward round, which is, why is over-oxygenating a patient who is a chronic CO2 retainer bad?
Putting me on the spot there. Is it because of reducing their hypercapnic drive?
No, that's no, necessary? Stop it, stop it, stop it.
Is it not?
No, okay, so this is a really prevalent sort of, I don't want to say myth, it sounds rude, but there's a really prevalent thought here, and I think this is the old way of thinking about it. There's this idea that there's a hypoxic and hypercapnic drive to breathe. This is wrong in the context of COPD. It's nothing to do with the brain. This is nothing to do with the brain, okay? The problem is in the lungs and how the body tries to adapt. The blood flow in the lungs is controlled by the principle of VQ matching, okay? AKA, if there is a well-oxygenated area of the lung, sending blood there is a sensible idea. If there's a poorly oxygenated area of the lung, sending blood there is a waste in terms of respiration. So in COPD patients who are chronic CO2 retainers, giving them oxygen will upset that delicate VQ mechanism. This leads to oxygen accumulating in the lungs, including in the places that we said are normally useless dead space. And because of that, the body senses the oxygen coming in and it increases the perfusion to those parts of the lung to try and grab all that fresh oxygen. It increases the supply to the dead space. And that all sounds fine and good, but remember that CO2 is retained in the dead space regions. That's where it gets stuck. And also remember that hemoglobin prefers CO2 to oxygen. It's called the Haldane effect. So all you've now done is shown the hemoglobin to a load of CO2, which it takes on instead of the oxygen that's now sitting there. That means that they are still hypoxic, but they now have a load of CO2 in their blood via the hemoglobin, which causes a respiratory acidosis, and together with hypoxia means type 2 respiratory failure. So somehow giving them oxygen is really not help, because all you've done is allow them to recruit a load of CO2 into their blood.
That's not even remotely related to respiratory drive.
I know, right?
What a shock.
But there it's you like, go. There you go. And with that bombshell, we're done.
Hi everyone, this is Sally and I'm here with a quick summary on COPD. So COPD is diagnosed by spirometry with an FEV1 over FVC ratio of less than 70%. The gold staging is used to assess its severity. COPD is comprised of actually two conditions, chronic bronchitis and emphysema, chronic bronchitis being a regular productive cough for 3 months in a row for at least 2 years, whereas emphysema is the damage and enlargement of the alveoli forming bullae. Patients tend to become tolerant to high CO2 levels over time, and it's important to know that patients who are CO2 retainers should not be over-oxygenated because it can cause type 2 respiratory failure. We classically aim for O2 saturations between 88 to 92% for COPD patients, and this can be achieved using a Venturi mask. In a community, COPD patients may present with chronic bronchitis or progressive shortness of breath in a context of a heavy smoking history. In terms of hospital presentation, you may see an acute exacerbation of COPD, which can be due to an underlying infection. At the bedside, look for inhalers, oxygen equipment, cyanosis in the skin, asterixis, and or a barrel-shaped chest, which will be hyper-resonant to percussion, with wheezing on auscultation. To investigate, you would usually use an ABG and chest x-ray at the minimum. Acutely, we would treat conservatively with oxygen via Venturi, medically with inhalers and steroids, and if there's severe type 2 respiratory failure, ventilation. Chronically, COPD is treated via the MDT. Conservative measures include chest physiotherapy, patient education and vaccination. Medical treatment would include inhaler therapy and potentially long-term oxygen therapy or non-invasive ventilation. Surgical measures, reserved really for patients with severe emphysema, could be lung volume reduction surgery. Key complications of COPD include increased risk of developing lung cancer, pneumothoraces, and infections, including COVID-19.